Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou. Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people. We're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He's the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the publisher and editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, Paul.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show, John.
Paul, a lot to cover today, and none of it's good, at least in my estimation. I'm going to start with a story that spread like wildfire on social media, along with clips and video and photographs. And this was the arrest of an 8-year-old boy in Florida. Now, this poor boy suffers from attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and anxiety. He had a meltdown in class. And what did the school do? The school called the cops. The cops arrived and to cuff this boy. And this kid couldn't have weighed more than 70 pounds. They tried to cuff him.
The news article says he weighed 64 pounds and was 3.5 feet tall.
There it is. There it is right there. He was so small that the cuffs couldn't fit properly on his hands. Why would the cops cuff somebody who's clearly having a mental problem?
Well, I think the bigger question is, what are they doing arresting 8-year-olds and charging them with felony battery in the first place? I think this is almost, you know, one of the good examples we have of the growth of the American police state. And what we've seen, I think, in the last couple of decades is the normalization of a police state response to everything. I'm 55 years old, and I can say that at least when I was in school, and I think 8 years old, were we talking third grade here, the police were never called to the school to deal with an 8-year-old. And I think that's kind of like it's both a failure of our educational system as well as of the police state, that really you need several heavily armed policemen to deal with an 8-year-old having a bad day. And I think that's, the normalization of having police in our schools, of immediately calling the police for everything, and criminal charges. And I think that's one of the things that when I'm reading about this and saying that an 8-year-old was charged with felony battery, it's kind of like, we don't need to be a first-year law student to know that the children of that age can't form criminal intent. So,
no. And let's look at that felony battery, too, if I could interrupt you for 1 second. It says here that this poor boy had been restless in class. A substitute teacher punished him, and then she approached him. He said to her, "Don't put your hands on me," and then he hit her. There were no injuries. I mean, it was a slap from an 8-year-old. And then the cops were called to charge him with felony battery.
And sadly, it gets even worse from there, though. I think that not only did the police come and attempt to handcuff him, even though his wrists were too small because, well, he weighed 64 pounds. But, you know, at the end of the day, though, when all was said and done, he was arrested. He was taken to the jail. He was fingerprinted. They took his DNA and they took his mugshot. And he's 8 years old. And I think this is one of the things, too, though, is that when people ask, you know, well, how did the United States become the biggest prison nation in world history with 2.5 million people locked up in cages? And well, a good place to start is when you're locking up 8-year-olds. And the saddest thing, though, is it said that it took 9 months before a prosecutor dismissed the charges. And it's kind of like, you know, this is, and of course, you know, I don't know how much it costs, but just the fact that, you know, it just kind of goes from bad to worse. But I also kind of wonder, you know, what country or what place in the world does an 8-year-old having a temper tantrum or a bad day in class result in a felony arrest? But this is not an isolated incident. On this show, we've talked about the 5-year-old girl who was not just arrested, but tasered by the police. And she was in kindergarten. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, I've kind of wondered at what point the countries or nations degenerate to the point that their children are treated like, I'm not even going to say like dangerous criminals. I'm not even sure like what, but like that they're treated so brutally and callously. And I guess the thing that I ask myself when I read stories like this, and let's keep in mind, this happened in a public school. The handcuffing of this child and the arrest happened in a public school. Presumably there's school administrators there. There's teachers there. And everyone thinks this is okay, apparently, starting with the teachers who called the police and who stood by and watched the police do this to this child. And then when I see the police officers doing this to this child, I'm wondering, like, you know, did they have children? Would they want this to happen to their child? I mean, what parent in their right mind thinks that it's an acceptable response to have your child handcuffed and arrested by the police because, well, you know, they're 8 years old and they're having a bad day. And at the end of the day, what can an 8 year old really do? I mean, there's a reason that they're children at that age and they need protection and care. And, you know, I don't know, it's just one of those things I think about, you know, the trauma of having to go through as an 8 year old child, of having to go through the process of being arrested, taken to a jail, handcuffed, fingerprinted, and having his mugshot taken. And the fact that no one at the police station, when the kid shows up with the police escort, no one at the police station thinks there's a problem with this either. And I think that's how normalized this level of brutality and just callous disregard for just such basic fundamental human rights has gotten.
Yeah, absolutely true. Let's stay in Florida. I saw this in CNN. It was in ABC. It was pretty much everywhere yesterday and the day before. And that is a sheriff in Florida is now forbidding his own staff and forbidding visitors to the sheriff's department from wearing masks. There's this ongoing joke where if you just go to Google and type Florida man and hit enter, you see what comes up first and you post it on Facebook and people get a good laugh out of it. But this is what's coming up first now. This Florida sheriff is not allowing people to wear masks. If you are wearing a mask and need to go into the sheriff's department to report a crime, you are not allowed entry.
Yeah, this is Marion County Sheriff Billy Woods. And so, yeah, he's banned anyone from visiting the sheriff's office, you know, from wearing masks and saying they cannot be worn by any on-duty employees. And I think it's worth noting that the sheriff typically runs the jails in the county. And this is no exception. He runs the Marion County Jail as well. And as someone who lives in Florida, this is one of those things that just kind of has me and a lot of other people scratching our heads. But it's worth noting, though, that the city of Ocala, which is located in Marion County, passed an ordinance mandating people to wear masks inside of businesses. And then it was vetoed by the mayor. But now we've got the sheriff giving contradictory orders and saying that no one in the sheriff's department or sheriff's property are going to wear masks. And this is the context that Florida set a single day record for the most deaths related to COVID-19. So it's kind of like, you know, not, I guess it shouldn't be a surprise that when you've got some government officials giving the orders not to wear masks at all, not in public, not in their buildings and such. And, you know, and he's saying that they will be fired. And he concludes his email telling police officers and sheriff's deputies not to wear masks while they're on duty so they can clearly communicate with the people they encounter. And his response is that, you know, my orders will be followed or my actions will be swift to address. And it's one of those things of, you know, like I say, this is one of the things that leads to a lot of head scratching by people that live here, especially when we're watching both infection rates continually rise and we're watching a death toll that continues to grow exponentially.
And speaking of death toll, let's move over to California. You published an article in Prison Legal News talking about the medical director of California's prison system. He's been fired. He's been fired because he's continued to order the transfer of prisoners, and there's been a consequent spike in COVID-19 infections.
Yes, and I think, you know, in California as well as around the country, even as COVID is, you know, rampaging through prison systems and jails, the transfer of prisoners around the vast American gulag continues. And this includes prisoners going from jails to prisons after they've been convicted. And within the prison system, prisoners are being shuffled around. And I think that one of the things that's important to note for, I think, a lot of listeners is that the American prison system generally is one where they shuffle prisoners around for no real reason. And there's constantly, on any given day, there's tens of thousands of prisoners on buses going from one prison to another. And typically, it's not like there's good reasons for them. They're just being shuffled around just because. And one would have thought that because of COVID, that this would have eliminated or reduced the numbers of prisoners that were being moved around, but not so. And in California, you know, in California, what we've seen here is the prison doctor, Stephen Therat, he transferred 100 COVID-19 positive prisoners from one prison to a bunch of others, spreading the disease around the California prison system. You know, I don't know. It's one of those things where when you're reading this stuff, you're wondering, okay, is he doing this to deliberately spread the disease? And you're wondering, are people really that stupid or are they that cruel and malicious and evil?
I received a letter this week from a prisoner in Oklahoma City in the federal transportation hub. He's in the camp attached to the hub. And this is quite a long letter. It's 7 pages, but I want to read just one paragraph. He says, here in Oklahoma City, in July, the number of positive cases of COVID-19 has surpassed April, May, and June combined. And I heard yesterday that 2 inmates at the camp went to medical with 4 of the 8 symptoms and asked to be tested. And the physician's assistant wanted to test them, but the doctor said no. We received a shipment of the $20 15-minute tests yesterday, but they're refusing to use them. Even the staff who were in contact with known staff members who are positive were refused a test when asked. On Tuesday, I printed out the numbers from Seagoville FCI, that's another federal prison, and it said of the 1,798 inmates, more than 1,300 were positive for COVID-19. Carswell, Texas numbers are just as bad, so it seems they really don't care about us. Well, that's true, isn't it? They don't care about prisoners. They don't care if they're positive.
And I think that's one of the things that we've seen, like, you know, time after time after time since, I mean, even before the COVID epidemic, I think it was readily apparent. But I think one of the things that's just been seen over and over is that between politicians and the prison and jail officials that, you know, run the American gulag, that they really don't care about the prisoners in their custody, and they view them as very much of an expendable population. And especially when we're seeing, like, you know, so many of the actions that are taking place where just so many of the prisoners are literally left to their own devices and are being left to, you know, both to, in some cases, to die and in other cases to get infected. And we're getting lots of letters of prison legal news from prisoners just saying that, you know, they've contracted COVID, they're asking medical help, and that basically as long as they're able to basically stand on their own 2 feet, or, you know, as long as they're not obviously dying, that they're not getting any medical care at all. Like, you know, they're not even getting aspirin, they're not even getting Tylenol, they're just being left there to suffer and die, or suffer and hopefully make it through it. And I think that that's just one of the things that I think that for a long time, it's readily apparent that the government just doesn't view the suffering of its prisoners, it doesn't view the suffering of its citizens. As soon as people are put in a cage, it doesn't view their suffering, their misery, as being anything worthy of either attention or much less not inflicting it. And I think that's one of the things that is, you know, kind of sadly lacking is that, you know, we don't even start from a premise of first, don't make things any worse than they are. And when you see these reports around the country, it seems like things are bad. Now let's see what we can do to make it worse. And the California medical director taking a bunch of infected prisoners and then shuffling them around the state on government vehicles to infect a whole bunch of prisoners at other prisons is just making you wonder, you know, is this intentional evil and maliciousness? Does he want to make a bunch of people sick, or is he just that grossly incompetent?
Yeah, indeed. You also published a piece in Prison Legal News that was just shocking to me. I read it when the magazine first arrived at my house. I want to talk about it here. This happened in New York. A prisoner was brutally beaten by prison guards. That happens a lot in prisons. It's usually unreported. The reason this is in the news is this prisoner killed himself after being beaten by these guards. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this is the case of Dante Taylor, and he was found dead in his prison cell at the Wendy Correctional Facility in New York State. And he was 21 years old when he went into prison, and he left at the age of 22 in a body bag. And he had mental health issues, and as well as a history of suicide attempts. And he was in prison, and he was brutally beaten by guards. And this happened in 2017. We're reporting it now because this is when the lawsuit was filed.
Right. We didn't know about it until this. That's right.
Exactly. And so what the lawsuit reports is that a group of guards, he was basically having a mental health breakdown, and guards came to his cell and they beat him beyond recognition. And after the beating had stopped, he was hogtied. and then thrown down a flight of stairs face first. And this type of brutality is actually fairly common in prison systems in the prison system in New York and many other states. We report this type of beating on a regular basis. And typically the guards, you know, were never disciplined or held accountable. So he was taken to the prison infirmary and then he was transferred to an outside hospital to get his injuries treated and then taken back to the prison. And he was placed in segregation and he asked to call his mother, which was denied. And the thing was, he had a history of past suicide attempts and he told staff that he wanted to kill himself. But rather than putting him on suicide watch, they placed him in a cell by himself and he hung himself. And he put a bed sheet around his neck and tied it to the cell bars and took his life. And I think that this is one of the things that, you know, this is common. I think a common response, unfortunately, with mentally ill prisoners that are the victims of brutality is their mental illness is exacerbated by beatings and poor treatment and they get despondent and kill themselves. And in New York State, I mean, this is not the first one, or this is a relatively common issue because in 2018, New York State Medical Board had found that over 50 New York State prisoners had died because of inadequate medical care, and many of them were suicides. You know, these are ongoing issues that, and it's interesting too, is that this happens in New York, and I hear people talk about Governor Cuomo and supposedly how progressive New York is, yet brutality in its prisons and this type of behavior is unfortunately very common. It's been going on for years. It doesn't matter who's in the governor's office. It still seems to perpetuate itself and continue year after year.
Yeah, that's true. Paul, prisoners harm themselves all the time. There's a lot of mental illness in prisons. And in fact, I read in one study, they said as many as 85% of federal prisoners have some form of mental illness. Now, oftentimes that mental illness causes them to self-harm. Why isn't more care taken to ensure that they don't do that?
I think at the end of the day, it's part of the reality is the government just doesn't want to spend the money treating the mentally ill in prison. I think that one of the reasons that such huge percentages of mentally ill prisoners are in prison is because basically the government's made a conscious decision to criminalize mental illness and take people who probably 30 or 40 years ago would have been in a psychiatric institution. And basically they'd rather lock them up and put them in prisons and jails with inadequate staffing, little to no mental health care, rather than put them in professional facilities that would provide that care. And I think it literally comes down to a cost measure. I've heard legislators talk about the fact that it costs anywhere from $200,000 to $300,000 a year to keep someone in a psychiatric facility versus $20,000 to $30,000 to keep them in a prison cell. And it literally seems to be about caging people based on budgets rather than seeing that people get treatment in that. I think this especially comes up with people who have what's called dual diagnoses. Typically, they have a mental illness, they self-medicate with drugs or alcohol, that worsens the mental illness. This leads to kind of a spiral of decline. It worsens behavior, they engage in criminal activity, and then they wind up in the criminal justice system, and then it kind of goes downhill from there even further. So these are all things that are just, you know, even more problematic. And I think that, you know, we just see this around the country in all 50 states, the federal prison system, and it's one of those things of it doesn't seem like at any level there's any desire to change this. And even when you have people that are dramatically and seriously mentally ill, there's little interest in seeing that these people get any type of treatment or help. Every time there's a mass shooting, I wonder maybe if the United States had a public mental health treatment program, this tragedy would have been averted and the person wouldn't have done something like this. But we don't get much. No one in political office in this country seems to view things that way. Instead, prison is the solution to everything.
We're speaking with Paul Wright, who joins us from Lake Worth, Florida. He's the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Paul, we've spent a lot of time over the past couple of years on this show, in this segment, talking about the disgraceful condition of the Alabama prison system. Now Alabama is saying that it will reform its prisons. These are the deadliest prisons in America. We've heard this song and dance before. Do you think they mean it this time?
No, I mean, this is in the context that the Alabama prison system has been the subject of litigation for literally decades, like 50 years, I think almost as long or longer than we've been alive. And the Alabama prison system was first sued, I think, in 1972 or 73. And after a two-day trial, a federal judge put the entire Alabama prison system under federal court supervision to basically kind of drag them kicking and screaming into the 19th century. And I don't think they've ever made it into the 20th century. But the prison system was incredibly brutal. Armed prisoners provided the bulk of the security staff at Alabama prisons at the time, as they did in much of the South. And that was the norm. And it's interesting, when I've talked to lawyers who have litigated these cases, including the beginning ones, I've asked them, do you think things have gotten better or worse? And it's like, well, it's all relative. In the 1970s, they didn't have prison doctors. Medical care would be provided by a prisoner who'd been a corpsman in the Navy or a medic in the Army. And that was the medical care they got. So from the early 1970s until the late 90s, the Alabama prison system was under federal court supervision, and things got better. They didn't really improve a huge amount, but they got much, much, much better. But then when federal court supervision dissolved, it wasn't because the courts found that, oh, everything's constitutional, everything is great now, but rather what happened was Bill Clinton and Congress passed a law called the Prison Litigation Reform Act that allowed states to go in and dissolve court orders and consent decrees around prison conditions, even when the conditions hadn't improved. And so the court orders were all dissolved in the mid-90s, late 90s, right after the Prison Litigation Reform Act was passed. And basically, we've seen 20 plus years of steady decline and worsening of conditions. And no one in the political class in Alabama, not the governor, not the legislature, not the state judiciary, has shown any interest in doing anything positive or anything good about the Alabama prison system. So it's degenerated into a bunch of crumbling buildings that are massively overcrowded with huge problems at every level, starting with overcrowding, lack of adequate medical care, lack of mental health treatment, and just over-the-top levels of violence, both prisoner-on-prisoner and staff-on-prisoner and everything else. It's quite the train wreck. And neighboring states like Mississippi and Georgia are not much better.
Yeah, Mississippi and Georgia, along with Alabama, three of the worst systems in all of America. We've got a little bit less than 5 minutes left, so I want to talk about something that is important to me, and that is the corruption of prison guards. We see prison guards across America every month in Prison Legal News magazine being arrested and charged with a variety of crimes. Well, there was a prison guard just recently arrested for trying to meet up with what he thought was a teenage girl, and it turned out to be a police officer. This is right out of To Catch a Predator. Tell us about that.
Yes, this was in Kingston, Pennsylvania. A federal prison guard named Ernest Pittman contacted an undercover policeman who was posing as a 15-year-old girl. And basically, Pittman sent the police officer over 100 sexually explicit texts, emails, and messages saying that basically he wanted to have sex with her. Then basically in August, police basically set up a meeting with them to go meet the imaginary teen. And when he showed up, they arrested him. And of course, Pittman had a loaded firearm in his car and his federal credentials identifying him as a federal prison guard. And he's admitted to sending, not only did he admit to sending the messages to what he believed was a 15-year-old girl, but he also admitted to doing it from his work email while on the job at the Federal Correctional Institute in Otisville, New York. So it's kind of like our tax dollars at work here. And unfortunately, this is all too common. I mean, we in Prison Legal News, we have a news and brief section where we report on stuff like this. And it's just like every month, there's just lots and lots and lots of cases of prison and jail staff basically doing everything from committing sexual assaults, rapes, getting arrested in drug stings, you name it. But they're engaged in plenty of criminal activity. And I think this is the proverbial tip of the iceberg. This is just the stuff that's getting caught, and then B, that's getting reported in the news media somewhere.
I think you're exactly right. We've got about 2 minutes left. Tell us about this sheriff's deputy who was arrested for having sex with a female jail inmate. Now, this is, of course, against the law because being a prisoner, you can't consent to having sex with your jailers.
Yeah, so this is one of those things that, unfortunately, the sexual assault of prisoners around the country has been, I think, a national disgrace and scandal for decades. And unfortunately, you have way too many jail and prison guards who think that raping the prisoners in their custody is just a job perk or part of a salary perk or benefit that they get. And this is one of those all too common stories. This story comes to us out of Ventura County in California. A 49-year-old jail guard, Leonard Herrera Lopez, was charged with entering the prisoner's cell and forcing her to have sex with him. And I think it's interesting to note, though, is that this is only being prosecuted as a misdemeanor. And I think that that's one of the things that all too common, yes, he's been charged with a crime, but all too often, anytime you talk about sexual predation, sexual violence, and then you want low prosecution, and then when people are convicted, very light sentences and lenient punishment, look no further than when government employees commit sex crimes against prisoners and arrestees. And even in the cases where they are prosecuted, they're what I would call very lackluster prosecutions, and punishments are extremely light.
Paul, we will leave it there. We're out of time. We were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He's the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area, and in Kansas City on 104.7 and 102.9 FM and 1140 AM. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.